Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. My guests today are Brad Lammensdorf and David Tice. Brad serves as the portfolio manager and owner of the sub-advisor for the AdvisorShares Ranger Equity Bear ETF, ticker symbol HDGE. He has served as a portfolio manager and principal of Ranger Alternative Management since 2009, providing trading and marketing strategy for short-only positions. In January 2013, he commenced operations and serves as the principal of the Lammensdorf Market Timing Report, or LMTR, a newsletter which provides subscribers with technical analysis and which will be familiar to many Seeking Alpha readers. David Tice founded the Prudent Bear Fund, ticker symbol BEARX, and served as portfolio manager from 1996 to 2008. He began his investment career in 1988 by publishing Behind the Numbers, an investment research service that focused on quality of earnings warnings and sell recommendations for more than 150 money managers, gaining national recognition through several Barron's articles he wrote and from hundreds of appearances on business television. He recently joined Ranger Alternative Management and serves as the Chief Investment Officer of Hedge. He also currently serves as President of Tice Capital. Anyway, welcome to the show, gentlemen. It's really great you could join.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, glad to be with you, Jonathan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the timing is really important in terms of U.S. and global markets right now. I think it's pretty clear that we're sitting at an inflection point, the likes of which we haven't seen in a very long time. So, for example, one popular author on Seeking Alpha, Michael Guyad, his name is, he called the market action of the last month since the market bottomed on March 23rd the greatest disconnect between markets and the economy in history. How do you explain the action of the last month since markets bottomed on March 23rd and have basically gone straight up since then, roughly 25% or so?
So I can start, Brad. One, I'd say it's not really surprising. You know, from a technical analysis standpoint, we certainly have retracement, and it's not unusual after a big decline when markets get oversold for the markets to retrace, you know, but eventually resume the bear market. And so it could be at 38% tracement to 50% to 62% or so. And I think we're probably at about a 55% retracement. However, there's really been a disconnect in terms of this is unparalleled, the decline in the economy, and I believe we are in a recession. People have talked about there being a 30% decline in GDP, 25% unemployment, and Howard Marks was on CNBC the other day, and he said, if you look at you know, what's wrong with this economy, it doesn't seem like it's just a down, you know, 20% economy. And therefore, I think that we're going to retest lows. I think we're going to break through those lows. And therefore, it's a very, very dangerous period. People want to believe, people want to be optimistic. Yes, we did get oversold. You look at the 08 decline was 55%. And I could argue that this, you know, decline is much more broad-based, and it's not just affecting the financial sector and housing. This is significant with so many people out of work, and we have essentially burst five different bubbles, and therefore a 36% decline or so that we had, you know, off the high originally, and then this rally. This is not going to be a V. We're not going to be off to the races again. And unfortunately, I believe we have more pain to come in the markets.
Yeah, sure. And just to play devil's advocate here a bit, because I definitely share your bear thesis overall at this point. What would you say about the fact that, unlike in, let's say, the recession, the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, where there were really deep structural issues with the underlying U.S. and then global economy, that in this case, the underlying issues have really just been brought on one thing, COVID-19, something we know will eventually pass, this period will pass. And so if the underlying economic conditions were maybe late stage expansion, 2% GDP growth a year, there's no reason to suspect that we can't snap that back into place once a vaccine is invented for COVID or some kind of a silver bullet cure. And so in other words, it really is a very specific event with a clear end in sight. And so even though the entire economy has been shut down, it shouldn't necessarily be reflected in such heavy sell-offs.
So I'm a big believer in the Austrian School of Economics, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Schumpeter. And we believe that there have been a great number of excesses created, you know, over this last 11-year expansion. I believe that we were set up for a big decline. We had created a number of excesses. The banks were not in as much, you know, leverage position as they were in 08. However, you look at the buildup in corporate debt, we ended up having $2.5 trillion of triple B debt, which is just one notch below investment grade. And it grew at 14% annualized over the last 10 years. Our total junk debt is $1.2 trillion. We've had companies go out and take on massive amounts of debt to buy back stock. Most of the earnings per share growth, you know, over the last 10 years, the preponderance of it has come from companies buying back stock. We have many, many excesses in this economy. The growth rate has been significantly below what it was prior to 07, 08. We were an economy, you know, a bubble waiting for a pin. And the Wuhan virus, you know, simply provided the pin to prick that bubble. But this was a decline that was going to come anyway. We'd already inverted the yield curve. We had, you know, essentially artificially grown this economy through a lot of Fed largesse that it's now paled compared to the Fed largesse that we have going on now.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, one thing you can look at is that if you take away corporate buybacks, there actually were everyone else combined in U.S. markets has actually been a net seller over the last period. So without those corporate buybacks, they're really the only net buyer of stocks over the recent expansion period. So I think that is a case in point. So who's actually debt buying right now then, if corporations are not really able to use their free cash flow to buy back their own shares because of the current environment?
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. And we have essentially, you know, psychologically, you know, changed the way look at things. People talked about how the Great Depression, you know, changed attitudes, you know, for people that grew up in the 30s. There has been a lot of talk about what is going to be, you know, the attitude of consumers going forward. I think it's going to be a lot more savings, a lot more, you know, squirrel away some, you know, savings. Don't necessarily pay to have somebody blow dry your hair. You know, don't necessarily have your nails done, you know, twice a week. There's taking a more frugal vacation. deferring capital expenditures.
If anybody even lets you on a plane to begin with, right?
Exactly. And it's going to take a while, even though there's talk about opening up. There's a lot of people that are not going to go into restaurants. And I think a lot of people don't understand operating leverage, where some of these companies, even if you let people into a restaurant, if they're at 30% capacity or even 60% capacity, you know, that business model might not work anymore. And so a lot of companies are going to close down, and those jobs are going to be permanently lost. And one thing, we've had this massive, people call it a stimulus, but it's not really a stimulus. It's just a trying to sustain, to try to keep the wheels on. And frankly, I think it's going to be too little, too slow, and not long enough. You know, because I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to fall through the cracks. I think that it's not going to last long enough. And we've essentially resorted to modern monetary theory here, MMT, in order to try to keep the wheels on, in order to try to keep markets functioning. And this is truly a dangerous period. But And we don't know what's going to happen with this virus. We don't know if there won't be, you know, resumption of, you know, significant more outbreaks once we do minimize social distancing. The head of the CDC came out 2 days ago and talked about how in the fall and winter of 2020 is likely to outbreak even more significantly than what we've experienced so far. This virus can still mutate. If you look at the Spanish flu, the second outbreak was far greater than the first outbreak. So I just think there's a lot of risk to financial markets. We've never seen, you know, a decline like this. But Americans want to be optimistic. We want to snap back. You know, people have a long time called me pessimist, but I say that it's better to be realistic and you better take care of your money.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so one more point here on, or maybe counterpoint to that, which is that it seems like the Fed, as you've said, they've resorted to MMT, some of it with some precedents, some of it really unprecedented. You know, they're buying high yield corporate bond ETFs at this point to try to prop up some of that debt. What do you think about people that say simply don't fight the Fed? Isn't the Fed at some point, for example, going to start buying equities also to prop up markets? And of course, you know, you can worry about things like runaway inflation a few years from now, but in the short term, in terms of how investors should be allocating, what do you say to that argument?
Well, fighting the Fed has been a, you know, losing proposition. I believe that there are consequences to modern monetary theory. And you mentioned inflation picking up down the road. I think that is possible. There's people smarter than me that are saying that inflation is going to come back. And I don't have a direct call, you know, next 12 months on that. But this modern monetary theory is dangerous, and again, it's unparalleled, and it just doesn't make sense. Why can't we just give all Americans, 320 million Americans, $1 million and just everybody be happy? I mean, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, no, that is for sure, unless you want to turn into the, you know, the Weimar Republic or Zimbabwe or something along those lines. Yeah. So I'd love to move over to the AdvisorShares Ranger Equity Bear ETF, ticker symbol HDGE. Full disclosure, I am currently long the fund myself. I have been for really just about a week and a half at this point, I think. But to me, I think there's two really great things about the fund, and I'd love to hear both of you guys weigh in on it before we get into the actual process for selecting individual short positions, when to open them, sizing, when to close them. So The first thing I really like about this fund is that it offers investors like myself, a retail investor, the ability to hedge the long part of my portfolio without worrying about needing to understand derivatives and swaps, and without worrying about the losses from compounding as you end up with leveraged and inverse ETFs. And it's amazing to me how many people I speak to who buy funds that are inverse or double, triple leverage, hold them for months at a time, and then scratch their head. They can't figure out, well, I don't get it. It was a short S&P 500 fund, triple leverage. The S&P was down 20%. Why am I not up 60% right now? Why am I actually down also? So,
Jonathan, let's talk about that a second, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So just to be a little more clear about this phenomenon that's occurring. So the way that an inverse product works is they create an index, which is, let's call it the S&P 500, and then they want to mimic the inverse. So they set up a fund to do that, and then they go out and use swaps, futures, they can even use options, mm-hmm. or just outright stocks to short the general S&P 500. Let's use SH as example, or one of the index-oriented products that are out there. What ends up happening on the reset is think of an index level at $100. And let's say the market or the product fell 10%. So now you're at 90. Then because the product doesn't mark with an NAV like HDGE ETF, they basically compound on yesterday's price action or performance. So if the product was up 10% the next day after being down 10% the previous day, you only get back to 99. So try to do that 1,000 or 2,000 times, and you can see the slippage that these inverse products end up having. HDGE is an active ETF. We choose our positions, hand choose them, and with that, we don't have an index, so we don't have an index to not track. So we don't have a tracking issue, and we mark with an NAV like a mutual fund at the end of each day. So there's a very, very large difference between an active short-only ETF, which is shorting in type 3 accounts, which is your margin account, which is where any individual would short a stock, relative to these inverse products, which are really quite exotic when you really get into them.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's really well put. And so, for example, you know, the example you gave of falling 90%, falling 10% to 90, let's say, then you need to gain 11% on the upside. This is particularly problematic in a market like this one, where every day you seem to have a reversal of some sort or other. So in a market that's moving basically in a single direction, these kinds of products essentially can track an index properly. So they can track it two or three times as long as there's not that back and forth seesaw action. But the second that comes into play, these products stop behaving in the way that people expect them to. And just in defense of the issuers of these products, you know, firms like ProShares and Direction, they advertise all of these products as daily. They don't claim that they track these indexes at leverage or inverse over longer term periods of time. But the bottom line is there's a lot of misunderstanding out there and a lot of misuse of them. Okay, so that really touches on the first thing I love about your fund, HDGE, the fact that you're actually physically shorting individual stocks. There's no swaps, derivatives, and so there's no compounding or lack of proper tracking going on there.
And I'd also like to mention too that, you know, our positions are on our website the next day, every day. Mm-hmm. So we're very transparent too. People can see what we're short the next day, you know, after the previous day.
Yeah, sure. And we'll get into that a bit in terms of, you know, whether you're worried about things like front running at all. Well, let's get into it now. So we just had a new active model, which has seen the light of day. American Century launched two active ETFs. I don't know if you want to put that in scare quotes or not, the ETFs part of it. But essentially, they follow the Precinian model. They only need to disclose their position at the end of the quarter, which really is mutual fund-like. And so they have a NAV that gets published throughout the day, but it's impossible for anybody buying the fund to actually know what's in it in real time. Why are you not concerned about the sorts of concerns that most active managers have had that have kept them out of the ETF space and has kept them in the mutual fund space or the hedge fund space instead?
Sure. Well, we definitely have been looking at these new non-transparents. One of the things that we don't want to happen is we don't want our liquidity or our spreads to get affected. So we have been very interested in some of those. I do not think that we're particularly front run as it's set up now, and this is the reason why. One, the amount of money that we have under management, a couple hundred million dollars, for someone to come in and really push us around to make us have to cover something, which we really don't have any rules where we're disciplined portfolio managers, but our prospectus doesn't necessarily say, you know, gee, if a position moves from 2% to 3%, you have to cover it. So it's not like we're under any pressure. The majority of our companies are larger cap and liquid in general, and are probably much more difficult to push them around. If you're a $20 billion fund and do have enough money to push those things around, why are you trying to press a $200 million ETF around? It just, in my opinion, there's not enough juice in there to make it work. And we actually have run this scenario through with Virtu, which is the largest institutional broker in the United States. And they agree that it would be very unfruitful for someone to be trying to front run us in what we're doing. And the positions that we're putting on today, no one knows about until tomorrow. So it's not like people see us in the market today doing what we're doing today.
Sure, right. Whereas let's just take a really extreme example. If Will Danoff at Fidelity Contra Fund had to disclose his positions daily, a fund that size could take him weeks to actually get into a position or longer. So you could see what the concern would be there at that kind of scale.
I also had something interesting to even mention outside of hedge, the USO, which has been getting a lot of attention recently.
Yep, just a reverse split today, actually.
It's not an ETF, it's an ETN, and they've been having all sorts of problems with their futures with inside of that ETF and rolling and everything like that, which just kind of goes to show you that whatever you have in your underlying in an ETF is as important as the ETF.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen several funds in that space actually close up shop in the last few days, OIL being one prominent example. So
sure.
Yeah, definitely.
And now a quick break so I can tell you about one of my favorite investing services, EPB Macro Research, run by Eric Basmajian. Eric is head of macro research at Perval Global, a discretionary hedge fund specializing in global macro-driven trades across all major asset classes. He first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2017, building up a following of more than 12,000 investors and becoming Seeking Alpha's top contributor in the economy vertical through his unparalleled analysis of key macroeconomic trends and his ability to turn this analysis into actionable top-down portfolio advice. In addition to the steady stream of macro analysis subscribers to EPB Macro Research receive, they also gain access to Eric's model tactical asset allocation and long-only asset allocation portfolios, an active chat room, and direct access to Eric for all your investing questions. And of course, relevant to listeners of Let's Talk ETFs, those model portfolios are all ETF portfolios. These portfolios have beaten the S&P 500 month after month, right through the recent coronavirus bear market. You can hear Eric's thoughts on the current market by listening to episode 35 of Let's Talk ETFs in an episode titled A Top-Down All-Weather ETF Portfolio, Coronavirus Edition. Subscribe to EPB Macro Research by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Eric Basmajian That's BASMAJIAN into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for EPB macro research there. Start your 2-week free trial today. And we're back.
I mean, the other thing I really like about HDGE is the fact that it's actively managed. And so attempting to handpick names, let's say, that are most ripe for short thesis, as opposed to just shorting the entire market, the hope is that there can be some sort of alpha there. And unlike with, let's say, long-only funds, where there's maybe not a lot of history of being able to outguess the market, the short side of things has really very different dynamics. And so, you know, I like the fact that the fund is actively managed. So just out of curiosity, if we could start getting into what your process looks like for selecting candidates for inclusion in HDGE.
Sure. So we're looking at the entire market with stocks above $1 billion in market cap. And we start off with actually a fundamental screening process that is delivering us all in 6 or 7 different screens, so we don't get pigeonholed into just shorting value or just shorting growth. We don't short momentum. We tend to look for companies that are dogging it, that aren't necessarily, that are maybe under what we call distribution, where the up-down volume isn't really terribly great. And a company can turn into a fad stock. For instance, Zoom, people are talking about, does it really need a $40 billion market cap? I just saw Verizon get into the business. I know that Microsoft's in the business through Skype. But it's a momentum stock right now, and what we would like to see is some characteristics of distribution before we kind of start stepping in. So while we may not catch the top, we like to try to get the meat in the middle. We always tell people that we're probably not going to ever be short of bankruptcy, but we probably won't ever get caught up into a momentum stock as well, because we have technical stops on the majority of our positions. With that being said, we have about 70 or 80 positions.
And that's a large number, correct? I mean, it goes as low as 25 or 30 in different market conditions.
It can get more concentrated, no doubt about it. In this environment, where we've opened up our the amount of names, and we're probably close to about 70. Our targeted percentage is about 1-2% right now. So we're not taking necessarily big concentrated positions, but really spreading the spectrum. But the characteristic of what we like to short are companies that are playing shenanigans with their balance sheets, companies that are pulling forward revenues, companies with negative free cash flow, companies with negative organic growth that are issuing buybacks with debt, that have levered up their balance sheet, companies that have basically put themselves in a box where, as David so eloquently said, you know, a modest pinprick creates a huge problem for them. They don't have these bullet sheet balance sheets like Microsoft and Amazon. So when the market goes up, these tend to have a little higher beta. So if we're 100% short a much higher beta portfolio and we walk away from the market, you know, market was up 30% last year, we were down about 34%. You know, we'll take it. We are an alpha generator, so we do like to try to beat the indexes. However, a lot of the alpha generation that the fund tends to create is to the downside when you need it the most. So during this correction, the market at one point was down 35%. We were up as high as 50% at one point. So the excess alpha that we generate on the downturns is really what has made the fund popular, just us interacting with our shareholders.
Yeah, sure. And how much do things like cost to borrow, which can vary greatly by individual companies, or risks of a short squeeze, how much does that get factored in when selecting individual names?
Yeah, we really shy away from highly shorted stocks or stocks that are commanding a very high interest rate. And what Jonathan's talking about to the viewers is sometimes a stock that you have to borrow from a bank to then short into the market, sometimes they will say, well, this is a very sought after borrow, and we're going to charge you 1 or 2% interest on that while you're shorted. Some crazy stocks like GoPro back in the day got up to a 100% a year borrow rate, which means you have to make 100% just to break even if you were short for a year. So we shy away from that kind of stuff. The cheapest form of shorting is called general collateral. And the majority of our positions you'll find are in general collateral.
Sure. And the expense ratio on the fund is not variable, right? It stays the same. So you kind of have to figure out a way to...
No. It's variable.
It is variable. Okay.
So we're a liquid alternative manager. So we charge 150 basis points for our management fee.
Sure.
And we charge about 15 basis points in expenses. And the other 150 basis points are ex dividends and ex interest that we have to pay to be able to be short. And frankly, I really feel like those expenses should be hitting the fund, because if I'm shorting a stock at 50 and it costs me 2% a year to short it, and the stock drops to 25 and I make 50% of my money, I have a profit in the fund, and then I have a 2% expense ratio to cover, to carry that position that goes on the expense ratio line. Frankly, I feel like it should go over into the profit and loss column for the trade, but the accounting rules of the United States would tend to differ with me.
Okay, I guess you got to go with those then. But yes, I would tend to agree with you. It does make sense. In the same way, they do nick the expense ratio out of the net asset value. So yeah, it would make sense. Agreed. So just curious, before we get into individual positions sizes here, I'm just looking at the sector breakdown here. And surprisingly, it looks like, at least currently, the sector that you have the smallest allocation to is the energy sector. Obviously, oil and forward month contracts going negative for the first time ever, and you know, crashing all down the futures curve have been in the news a ton lately. And I'm just curious if that's just a product of the fact that that sector has sold off so much already, or if there's other reasons that you're not more allocated to energy shorts right now.
No, your first was correct. We were about 15% short coming into this mess, and I covered the majority of it on the lows during March.
Okay, cool. So on a day like today, where you, or the last couple of days, let's say, where even though oil has really, the bottom has really fallen out of it in an unprecedented way, you've seen E&P companies actually being among the best gainers in the market.
That's right.
This would be a sector, I assume, that if prices stayed really low for an extended amount of time, would be ripe for shorting again if you saw those stocks move up to levels you felt that they were ripe for the picking at.
Yeah, sure. If we could get some of those stocks back up to their 50 and 200-day moving averages, you know, we would be interested again to look at some of them again. But it's kind of hard when stocks have dropped, you know, 80, 90% to stay short them. And when I first mentioned, you know, we probably will never be short of bankruptcy, it's just very, very difficult to short something all the way into zero. There's a lot of volatility, and, you know, the debt guys and the real distress guys come in and start lending them money, and it just becomes a little less consistent of a game down at that level.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the risk reward obviously starts turning more towards reward the closer to zero the thing gets. So yeah, definitely. Okay, so I guess let's just keep it on sectors for a second here. So you are fairly heavily short consumer discretionary, which I think, you know, is fairly obvious in this kind of an environment. But then you're also very heavily short financials. And just curious what the underlying thesis is there.
Well, it's a continued deterioration of, you know, the general economy, which is going to put a lot of pressure on their loan books across the boards. We actually were even more short than you see right now. We were short the entire subprime area with CIT. Mm-hmm. In a much bigger position in CACC. We should short it Synchronicity, SYF. So we had a CIT was another name that we had shorted. And we covered all those in April too, just because they had gotten so oversold. But I will say that this subprime area is a complete meltdown waiting to happen. There has been so much debt raised in these lower credit tranches, no matter if you look at the covenant light loans or you look at any of these different areas, it's pretty weak. So, we're just going to, stick with, the negative cash flow and stuff like that.
And just to add in there, in terms of, we believe this decline is going to be so significant, and a lot of people have talked about how the banks are in better shape going into this recession, depression than they were in 08. But J.P. Morgan just raised their reserves by 450%. And, I think that the magnitude of this decline being so unparalleled, even with all the, the payroll protection loans, et cetera, there are so many companies that are going to fall through the cracks that the banks are going to suffer a lot. And then you also look at the fact in a zero interest rate environment, financial institutions do not do very well.
Yeah, flat yield curve, et cetera, there's very little they can do to make money, particularly the regional banks, I would imagine, are in.
Also, I'd like to tell you a story. So ABS, which is really where some of the which is the car auto loans, mm-hmm. where we were a bit focused on, and I'd like to get some of that back on into this bounce somewhere. CACC is the most obvious position in that area that's vulnerable. But during the 08 period, the reason that ABS, which is the sector of the auto credit, has been so strong over the last 5 or 10 years is because during 08, it never broke. ABS was a great bet. Everybody was driving to the work and blah, 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 and using their car so they got paid. But the difference is the duration of that ABS paper during that period was 3 years. ABS paper now has exploded, has doubled in duration to 6 or 7 years. And if you start looking at the depreciation schedule of a used car, when you start moving into that 4.5 to 6th year, the depreciation in some instances can drop below the repo value of what the car is worth, creating a loss on the loan. And I think that that is going to be a huge issue. Used car prices have dropped year over year faster than any other period of time since 08 at this point. So you've got a depreciating asset with a lot of loans outstanding against that stuff that most likely will, they'll just turn in the keys to a asset that isn't worth as much as the loan still has left on the lease.
Sure, yeah, I have to imagine those default rates are gonna skyrocket soon. Also, I saw just across my news feed just a day or two ago that over 25% of auto loans are being deferred in the U.S. at this point. And I have to imagine in a few months, some of those people just default. They stop deferring at that point.
So anyway, CACC, we're still short a little, but it's definitely one of my favorite shorts for the auto credit.
So. Nice. Okay. So that you're short a little, you're saying. So what? How are you determining position sizes here?
So traditionally, we really magnet our position to a 1.5%. And then, traditionally price action will move us around a little. So if something's getting a little overbought, we may move that position up. If something's getting a little oversold, we may, trim it down some and take some profit. So our entry points and exit points actually are chosen a little more technically short term. We use a 14-day RSI. We use moving averages to help us. If a stock starts getting a little, for instance, if a 50-day moving average and a 200-day moving average, you had a stock trading in between those. And then, for instance, let's use CIT because it's a good example. It falls out of bed and the current price is 17 and the 50-day moving average is 50. So that's pretty far away from its mean. So we would like to see that gap closed a bit before we came back to the position. And sometimes it may just need sideways time.
Sure. And so I guess getting back into individual companies here, what are another couple of names that you're particularly bearish on right now and why?
Well, one we had done extremely well on, which was Wayfair.
Currently, you're top holding, correct?
It's probably toward the top just because the stock ran up. We covered half of it down at about 25, and then it's gone from 20 to 95 this month. But here's a company that doesn't make money, and they lose money. And they don't lose just a little amount of money. They lose a ton of money. And they've gotten some short-term business from this crisis. But the fact of the matter is you got Amazon and Target and Walmart and everyone else setting up the same type of furniture websites as they do and coming in with a serious balance sheets that Wayfair just is not going to be able to compete again. So the fact that this thing so cash flow negative and doesn't have in their business model an opportunity to make a profit for over 5 years at a minimum, and the fact that it's in such a competitive area with such razor thin margins is, you know, it's a red flag for us and a reason for us to be short.
Yeah, sure. Makes a lot of sense. And then is there another name that you wanted to throw out for listeners also? And of course, listeners can go to the advisorshares.com website and look for HDGE and see the full holdings, which are updated daily there.
Right. Another company that we've stayed short with inside of that finance area is Santander Consumer. They do mortgages and auto loans, and they've been real, real recklessly aggressive in the past. And I actually it's one of those stocks, it's at 12, it's down from 25, but I wouldn't be surprised to see this go back to kindergarten, which, you know, basically means low single digits. I think a lot of the ABS type stuff that I was mentioning before, these guys are right in the middle of it.
Yeah, sure. And then one other thing, which I think will be interesting to listeners. So you have to keep cash on hand, of course, to be able to cover positions. How do you determine? You have, I see here four different cash vehicles, although one of them is really insignificant, the Morgan Stanley one. But you have two money market funds, Fidelity and BlackRock. And then you also have an advisor shares fund, ticker symbol HOLD, which is roughly 34% of your cash position. And I'm particularly just curious about whether holding money in these funds, particularly HOLD, which did actually dip about 5% as the market was dropping. But even the money market funds, where we did see funds actually break the buck in 2008, if this adds some kind of unnecessary risk relative to the yields that these funds can offer in this kind of an environment.
Yeah, well, that was really a very unusual blowout that we had in all sorts of different items that shouldn't have gotten blown out like that. However, the HOLD is an advisor shares fund. We do use it. They do produce a bit over what the normal Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan type money markets can produce. What I will say is that we have spoken to Sage and we are going to continue to use the fund and they are going to lower their duration. Their duration was about 180 days and some of the other durations we have are a little less, probably more like 60 to 90 days. And they, after we spoke to them and that occurred, they're not going to freak out and just start blowing out positions. But about 30 to 40% of their positions will run off within inside of the next 60 days at 100 cents on the dollar. And a lot of the stuff that they own is AAA stuff, Budweiser type 60-day paper and things like that, that frankly shouldn't have gone to that type of spread. But with that being said, it definitely is a concern because our cash covers our liabilities and it really should not be taking any type of dip like that. And so you'll probably see a lower percentage in HOLD, and we may even add some T-bills into the mix to make sure that, you know, we have an adequate amount of liquidity.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. I mean, you saw that in a bunch of similar funds like MINT, which, of course, again, even if things are investment grade rated, when you look at why they maybe would have sold off by roughly 5 or 6%, also, then you start digging into the holdings, and I don't know about Budweiser, but you see things like General Electric there, and I could see why credit markets would be a little concerned about that, even if it's relatively short term, because there are companies that are investment grade rated that are close to it that do seem fairly risky in this kind of a market environment. So
Sage is the manager who runs HOLD, and they're probably one of the top fixed income managers in the United States. So the management is, you know, extremely solid. They do incredibly good fixed income work. I think they run about $20 billion in these type of strategies. And we definitely had a talk with them. And we definitely, they're going to tighten things up for us. So
we are definitely very cognizant of that risk and looking at that very carefully.
Yeah, sure. No, makes sense. Okay, cool. So let's move on from here. I think this has been really, really interesting so far. You guys obviously have a lot of thoughts on not only the overall outlook for markets and the economy, but how that actually drills down to specific companies. So just love if we could make some kind of a bold call here. No one's gonna hold us to it, but where do you think the S&P 500 will be at the end of this year on December 31st, 2020? You've got all kinds of investment banks who are basically paid to be bullish, saying things like it'll be at 3,000 or higher. Goldman famously made that call probably about a month ago. Where do you see the outlook, and where do you think the market will be at the end of this year?
David, you want to take a shot first?
Yeah. I'm going to say 1,500 on the S&P, which is down about 55% off its, you know, 3380 high or so. And I'm not necessarily thinking that's going to be the end. I believe that when you think about recent declines and even going back to 1987, so we saw the decline in 08 and the decline in 87 were just one and done. But then you also had the 1930s and you had 2000 to 2002. I think this is more likely to be, you know, one of those protracted declines that isn't necessarily going to be one and done. I think it's going to be grinding. Bear markets typically don't end until people are groveling and they never want to think about a stock again, instead of saying, okay, it's over, let's jump back in, you know, what are we going to buy? That's typically not how, you know, horrible bear markets end. And unfortunately, I think this is a big one. We've had a lot of excesses. We've talked about the corporate debt. We've talked about this altering people's attitudes. I don't think there's going to be as much pent-up demand as people think, because there are people that are just going to defer for some time, and we don't not really know, you know, how this virus is going to play out. So I think it's not going to be pretty.
I personally think that David, the 50% from top to bottom is correct. You got to think about where we came from coming into this. It's not just the virus. Debt to GDP was higher than it was in the fall versus 2000. So that's Warren Buffett's favorite indicator. That's why he had so much cash. Price to sales were 20% higher than the peak on the S&P 500 than the peak from 2000 and 07. So price to sales were very high. Now, price to earnings didn't look as high because everyone's been issuing debt and buying back stock to lower their PEs.
Sure, I was going to say, yeah, it's an accounting mirage.
So we also have another indicator out there, and a lot of these I put on my LMTR.com website under chart of the week in the fourth quarter. But you also have something called Tobin's Q, which is the replacement value of the market relative to its underlying assets, which also got to a 2000 level. So while most people may say this is bad luck that we just came across a 100-year flu and that they took the markets down, the markets were so overvalued. If the markets were realistically valued coming into all this, then the hit probably wouldn't have been as bad as it is now. But we came from such an overvalued position that real valuation metrics that I at least look at would make the market cheap at about 1500 to 1800. And when you look at those metrics, of course, that's usually when everything's looking the worst. And as David said, nobody wants to buy stock. And, you know, people are saying, just sell everything out of my account. I don't want to do have anything to do with the stock market anymore. Obviously, that's the times to be a really big buyer. And I just don't think, as David said, we're in that type of attitude. I will say that I do think that we, because of the liquidity that the Fed is injecting, we are going to have massive volatility. I mean, if you thought the boring, low vol environment we had over the last 3 or 4 years was probably like in the one of the lowest vol periods in the last 100 years, I think in the next 2 years, this is going to be one of the highest vol periods you've seen in the last year or two. Because investor psychology is moving around so aggressively, sometimes valuation has nothing to do with, the moves, you know, psychological moves when people start moving in herds.
Sure. So the bottom line I'm getting from both of you here is that COVID-19 is really just the catalyst, but this was already in the making for several years, probably looked like it was going to happen in the fourth quarter of 2018 and things turned around, but this was inevitable anyway. And once you have the catalyst, it almost doesn't matter how the virus plays out exactly. So there's going to be some, even if, you know, economies are opened up, there's going to be many people that choose to social distance. Many, many industries are going to be badly hurt. And the domino effects that have been set into motion where one industry turns over and then that, you know, oil and energy turns over and then that hits the banks and then that hits real estate and, manufacturing and every other sector is those pieces are already in place.
You know, and also too, everyone's thinking, oh, when they get the economy open, things will be better. I was listening to lots of different interviews, and one interview I was listening to was from a guy who runs a tractor supply store in Denver. And he says, I don't care about the business I'm losing this month or next month. What I care about is the fact that I could lose 20% of my business over the next year. And he goes, that is my profit. That's the problem here.
And that's a great point, as I mentioned before, the operating leverage, and that a company cannot afford, you know, to lose 20-30% off the top. You know, that doesn't mean its profits go down 20%. I mean, it means, you know, the profits go away. And then the whole economy is this kind of just in time. You know, we need to be operating exactly where we are. And you lose 5% or 10% off the top, it's severe. You lose 30 or 40% off the top, the impact on your profitability is extreme. And then you couple that with the fact that on the solvency side, you know, these companies and individuals also don't have much margin of safety, and they can't get through, you know, 6 months of a down period. A lot of times they can't get through 1 month of a down period.
Sure. All right. Well, anyway, hope you guys are wrong to some extent, just not even in terms of markets, just in terms of the massive amount of pain and suffering that it means for U.S. businesses, individuals, and people across the world who are experiencing similar things. But I guess what goes up must come down to some extent. And when you're leveraged to the extent that economies like the U.S. have been, there has to be some kind of a deleveraging process at some point.
I'm glad you said that, Jonathan, because, you know, Brad, John, and I are real people. We hate that people are going through pain and suffering and unemployment is high and people have lost loved ones in this. And, you know, we are not ogres, trying to, protect people's portfolio by providing a short side component to the portfolio. We truly hope every day we're wrong, and that we get through this positively. But our job is to objectively assess this and, try to do the best that we can for our clients.
Sure. It's well put. So anyway, before we wind things down here, and I want to thank you guys for being so generous with your time here today. What's the best place for listeners that want to further research either HDGE or other things you're working on, LMTR, et cetera? Where's the best place online for listeners to go and continue the research process?
So LMTR.com is our research portal, and it's free. You can sign up for a newsletter. And we send out stuff a couple of times a week, at least I do, chart of the week and sentiment update. Chart of the week is usually something that I see that is interesting relative to the time, current time. I was putting out lots of bearish charts of the week in the fourth quarter. At the lows, I actually was putting out some pretty bullish type charts of the week. So those charts of the week are actually pretty important to kind of look at. Then we also do a sentiment update where we're reviewing the optimistic or pessimistic nature of the participants within inside of the market through different gauges and polls. And we put that out usually on Thursday or Friday. And then David has recently just come on the site to start blogging, and he's going to start putting out a couple of pieces a month. And then anything on the HDGE ETF, you can go to advisorshares.com, and our fact sheet and data holdings and things like that are on the site there.
Nice. And we'll link to all that from the accompanying article in the description of the podcast on all the major platforms. So, Apple, Google, etc. And then what about social media? Are you guys doing anything on there? Anywhere for listeners to follow you? Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook?
We are on LinkedIn. David's on LinkedIn too.
Yeah, I tweet every now and then as well, but I'm going to start writing a little more for LMTR.
Nice. That's great. Anyway, I want to wish both of you best of luck, health, obviously, first and foremost. But also best in luck in everything you're doing right now. Definitely providing a very important service, allowing investors that really don't want to be long only have the ability, really in a relatively easy and simple way, to access the short side of the market without needing to be financial wizards and understanding all kinds of exotic products. So thank you for that. And I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. You're providing a great service to your listeners and readers.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're big Seeking Alpha users.
All right, great. Thanks, guys.
For disclosures, HDGE is currently short most of the stocks we mentioned in today's show. For a full list of holdings updated daily, go to advisorshares.com/ETFs/HDGE. I, Jonathan Liss, am long hedge in my personal investing account.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.